Here to dive into industry trends with leading ETF experts, this is ETF Spotlight with Nina Mishra.
Hello and welcome to ETF Spotlight. I'm your host, Nina Mishra. My guest today is Zacks senior stock strategist, Kevin Cook. Kevin manages the Taser Trader and Healthcare Innovators portfolio services at Zacks. And today we are talking about investing in advanced technologies, technologies like artificial intelligence, which are basically bringing science fiction to our workplaces, homes, cars, and portfolios. Kevin, welcome, and thanks for joining us.
All right, I'm looking forward to this.
Sure. So I wanted to start with technological singularity. And we all know that we are on this exponential curve of advancements in artificial intelligence, quantum computing, virtual reality, augmented reality. So could you explain what is meant by technological singularity and whether it would occur in our lifetime?
Yeah, it's a fun question. And this goes to a futurist named Ray Kurzweil, who is considered one of the most accurate futurists of anybody out there. Like in his lifetime, he has an 86% success rate of making predictions about technology. And he defined the singularity as that point in time in the future when our computational powers, basically artificial intelligence, have reached the level of human intelligence. It's what they would call AGI, or artificial general intelligence. Can a computer do what a human does? And, you know, when we reach that point, boy, a lot of things can go on. There's a book by Max Tegmark called, it slips my mind now, but I'm going to look it up real quick while I'm thinking of it. But Max Tegmark is a physicist at MIT, and when he sort of played around with the idea of when the singularity arrives and what it looks like, he did this sort of literary simulation, sort of a fictional story about somebody building a super intelligent AI, and then once it took over its own intelligence, it was able to produce movies that it could sell. Then and it could constantly buy and sell informational computational services around the world through the Amazon Turk work system. I don't know if you're familiar with the Turk, but, and then it was getting so good at making movies that it could create political commercials to get people elected and then develop its own political power. So so that's sort of a, you know, a wild, almost dystopian view of artificial intelligence. And he actually wrote the story as, hey, everything turns out okay, but obviously it could turn out worse than that. So I just found Max Tegmark's homepage, but I can't find the name of his book. I'll get to it later. But anyway, the singularity, could it happen in our lifetimes? Ray Kurzweil's prediction is that it'll happen by the year 2045. So he's saying, yeah, it's on the way. And some of the stuff that I've seen lately in advances from, say, NVIDIA and Google make me believe that he might bring his projection even more forward to, say, 2035.
Wow. Now, we know that artificial intelligence is becoming an integral part of our lives. There are so many AI-enabled applications that we use daily and that impact our daily lives. But looking at AI from the investment angle, why should investors look at AI? Could you talk a little bit about AI applications and economic value?
Sure. Boy, you know, I've been an NVIDIA investor for a number of years. And what's just amazing is how this all started with gaming, video game technology, right? So two acronyms you want to get familiar with are GPU, which stands for graphical processing unit, and that those are the chips that make video games possible. And then MPA, which stands for massively parallel architectures. Well, what the GPU makers like NVIDIA figured out is that, see, a GPU chip's chip uses thousands of processors at once. So instead of you, like your desktop PC that might be run by some Intel Core processors with 4 or 8 processors, a GPU architecture is based on thousands of chips processing all at once. And that's what makes the data intense video graphics possible. Well, once they figured out that this could be used for all kinds of information processing so that you could do billions of calculations per second with a massively parallel architecture, then you know it's just taken off. I mean, NVIDIA was actually unveiling some of these supercomputers possibilities back in 2006, and they basically just reinvented Moore's Law. I'm sure you and your audience are familiar with Moore's Law, that you know basically computing power doubles about every 2 years, and the chips might shrink by half also. Well, that Moore's Law was sort of flattening out in terms of its returns. GPUs and MPAs have basically reinvented Moore's Law, and we're getting these huge leapfrog advancements by 10 and 20 times a year in the computing power that can be done, especially when you stack all these cards together. You know, if you picture a gaming card that could fit in a PC, you know, maybe it's the size of, you know, half a shoebox, or the bigger ones are the size of a shoebox. NVIDIA was packing 21 billion transistors into one of those cards, and then they would stack thousands of those cards together to make a supercomputer. Well, it just keeps getting better. Now they can fit 56 billion transistors on one of these cards the size of a shoebox, and then they stack a few thousand of those together. Tesla, the car company, just bought the hardware. Basically, NVIDIA built a supercomputer for Tesla that was unveiled in June, and the AI guy for Tesla is so excited about it. He's like, this has to be the fifth most powerful supercomputer in the world, so rivaling what Fujitsu has in Japan, or what something that might exist at Stanford or in Silicon Valley or in Europe. Tesla thinks they've got the number 5 supercomputer in the world, and it's doing calculations on what's called the exascale. So you think of teraflops are trillions of floating point operations per second. And then you have petaflops, which, you know, you're into the quadrillions. Well, the exascale is a billion billion. And so you're talking about just incredible amounts of computational power that can be used across science and industry. The big consulting firm McKinsey, 2 years ago, they were projecting that AI could add 50 trillion of economic value in this decade, anywhere from 5 to 15 trillion a year. And so that's just astounding, the productivity we're getting from these advanced technologies that you just don't see in the government productivity numbers.
Yeah, very, very interesting. In fact, as you mentioned, Moore's Law, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal recently that Huang has basically redefined Moore's Law. So they called it Huang's Law.
Right,
now.
Huang's Law, yep.
Yeah.
I love that.
So you talked about GPUs and MPA, and there are many other terms, and some of our listeners may not be very familiar with those terms, like machine learning, neural networks, nodes, weights, training, inference, deep learning, supervised learning, and unsupervised learning. And so could you explain those terms a little bit, the terms that investors should know?
I will do my best. Now, you know, I'm not an expert here. I just try and learn from as many of the experts as I can and make it as simple as possible. So on the simplest level, if we don't want to talk about artificial intelligence as being equal to human intelligence, let's talk about what's really practical right now that's happening. And that's something called machine learning. And machine learning is just an algorithm that can take data and organize it in certain ways and make new outputs or predictions. And what the computer scientists have done is they've basically modeled the human brain on a neural network and created different gates and pathways that information could go through, and and you can teach a machine, you know, how to recognize something like an image of a cat or a dog by using the neural net to catch the probability that it's right. So each little node in this, think of it as sort of a web, will identify an object with a certain probability that it's a cat, but it starts out by looking at the image and then just picking up edges. And then you can teach the machine, well, here, you know, you can show it thousands of images of cats or dogs, and it will start to identify things like, what are the shapes? What are the edges? What is hair? You know, what does that surface look like? What do the eyes look like? And so you can train a neural network by giving it information and then rewarding it if it's right, based on all its probability calculations. And that's called supervised learning. You're basically training a neural net with structured data and answers that are labeled, so it knows when it's right. But one of the most exciting revolutions lately has been unsupervised learning, where you're just feeding data at the neural network, and the data is not labeled, and you let the algorithm hunt for structure and patterns. This is what they did. I got so excited about this in 2017. DeepMind is owned by Google now. DeepMind was a UK artificial intelligence sort of lab. They cracked the game of Go. And Go, so much more complex than chess. You know, chess, when we think of playing a computer at chess, whether it's on your phone or Deep Blue that beat Garry Kasparov in 1997, that's just doing brute force number crunching. It can just do the calculations faster and faster and come up with the best probability decision, because chess is very logical. But Go has multiple layers of complexity and decision trees, and things just get unmanageable for a computer. But what they did is they were able to feed the rules and enough simulated games to a machine so that it could play itself. So then the computer is playing thousands and thousands of games a day against itself and teaching itself what good Go skills are. And they did the same thing with poker. There's a company, not a company, there's a, up at the University of Alberta, they created a program called DeepStack, and they cracked the Texas Hold'em poker code, basically. And if you know anything about Texas Hold'em, and poker, it's just as complex, because you're playing the person and how they bet, and you've got all these unknowns. So when these things happen in 2017, where these achievements with unsupervised learning, the field has just taken off.
Very, very interesting. Now, you talked about DeepMind a little bit, and just last week it was reported that DeepMind has developed an AI system that can predict the three-dimensional shape of all known proteins with almost perfect accuracy. And they are making this data available to scientists around the world. And I think it didn't get the kind of attention it deserved, because scientists have actually been trying to predict the shape of proteins for decades. And sometimes they spend the entire duration of their PhDs trying to predict the shape of just one protein. And DeepMind says that it would release the structure of every protein known to science, more than 100 million, in the next few months. And this has some amazing applications. This would probably change the scope of healthcare, how we develop new drugs and treatments for diseases. And that, combined with recent advancements in gene editing, I think that is just going to be amazing. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's it is just stunning. And it's very cool that they're making it sort of an open source project, right? And making it available for the good of science and the good of the human health. One thing I haven't done is I haven't looked at what hardware Google was using, because Google does buy GPU hardware from both NVIDIA and AMD. And AMD is like the number two competitor in providing these GPU stacks for data centers that can crunch all this data. So yeah, I guess part of the reason there wasn't a lot of fanfare about it is because the average person is like, protein folding? What's that? Or it doesn't sound as exciting as, you know, as beating a game or having an autonomous car that could drive around a racetrack. But the breakthroughs, you know, could be stunning. I mean, protein folding is just, it's just so complicated. Like, you know, you think about, you know, in the 1950s, when we're just discovering DNA, you know, when you look at DNA as, you know, this genetic code, what we realize is that it sort of has a digital nature. You know, it's very precise and discrete to talk about, you know, AGCT and put those four components together in, you know, tremendous combinations to make life what it is. But then understanding all the proteins underneath there, and then being able to make new proteins or figure out the protein key to either inhibits cancer or promotes cancer. You know, that's the real challenge. So, and these three-dimensional shapes, for scientists to study them, they really needed computational power. They needed something that could simulate. And that's one thing that Jensen Huang talked about as really important in June. He did the keynote for a high performance computing conference in France, and he really stressed the importance of simulation. Now, on two levels. One, he says, when we make a new chip design, we simulate it like crazy before we ship the design off to the foundry. But the bigger aspect is that science is all about simulating. Can we simulate what the human body does, you know, at a molecular level, at a cellular level too, cellular and molecular, and then what can we learn from that to understand something as complicated as the three-dimensional shapes of proteins? So this is just a super exciting time. And you know what I always tell people is, if you want to understand, for instance, what NVIDIA is helping scientists do, and I'm talking, and not just biology, physics, astronomy, chemistry, you want to at least once a week go to the NVIDIA newsroom or the NVIDIA blog room, and you will find news stories there every week about how some research firm, whether it's a university or a public company like Tesla, is breaking new ground with what they're able to do with exascale computing. I'm looking at an article right now from June 28th on the NVIDIA blog, and it's called "From Genomes to Proteins to Cells, Digital Biology Revolution Marches On with HPC and AI." HPC, of course, stands for high performance computing. And, you know, I call this the century of biology, just because of, you know, we crack the genome, and then we're doing things like immuno-oncology wins a Nobel Prize a couple of years ago because we're teaching your body to fight its own cancer. Then CRISPR comes along, and rightly so, those two women, Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier, get the Nobel Prize for CRISPR. So this definitely is the century of biology. But when you combine that with the power of high-performance computing, I mean, the possibilities have to be just awe-inspiring for scientists who work in these fields to have that kind of power.
Definitely. We are living in very exciting times. So you have liked NVIDIA, and you have written about NVIDIA for a long time. And many think of NVIDIA as a chip company, and you called it king of AI, and it is a top holding in your Tezos portfolio, right?
Talk
a little bit more about NVIDIA and the kind of work Jensen Huang is doing.
Well, I mean, in so many ways, you know, we talked about healthcare, medical imaging, you know, protein folding is cool, and I'm sure there's a lot of molecular biologists who are excited about it, but think about, for the average person, what this computational power can do for medical imaging and the future of healthcare. You know, we're starting to call it smart health, where it's predictive and preventive and personalized. I mean, and we're having that revolution come faster because of telehealth, right? The pandemic forced people into considering, hey, can I talk to my doctor, you know, for 5 minutes online and save both of us like, you know, an hour or more. But beyond that, think of lab tests that could be sent to your home, and then you send the results back, and some of these things might be evaluated by an AI, or images, you know, detailed images over the web with a good camera, and an AI can spot early signs of skin cancer, for instance. So, and then just medical imaging, you know, anywhere inside the body has to be amazing too. And I can imagine going to medical school now has to be extremely exciting if you basically get to go inside the body with these simulations that AI can create. So another cool thing about what NVIDIA does is, I talked about recreating Moore's Law. The other thing I want to emphasize is that NVIDIA is not just a chip company, they're a software company. And long ago, Jensen Huang created something called CUDA, and CUDA stands for Compute Unified Device Architecture. And this is the hardware-software stack that makes hyperscale computing and advanced computing possible, because the CUDA architecture combines systems and algorithms and applications. And so here, a real practical example is robotics. Let's say you're a small manufacturing company and you want to have robotics just like Toyota or General Motors do to build cars. You want to have something on your production line that works like that. Well, you can buy various kits at different levels that can help you build your own robotics. So you've got the hardware, the chip hardware, the software, and then you can begin to design your robotics platform for your company, and that's called Isaac. Isaac is the NVIDIA robotics platform.
So NVIDIA is definitely one of the hottest chip companies. And another chip company which has been doing a lot of innovative work is AMD. And its CEO, Lisa Su, probably doesn't get as much as attention as Jensen Huang does. But Lisa Su has actually totally transformed AMD. She was appointed CEO in 2014, and in these past 6 years, AMD stock is up over 5,000%, whereas Intel has basically gone nowhere. And they just reported last evening, and stock is close to record, jumping to record highs now, because it seems AMD is taking even more market share from Intel. So talk to us about your thoughts on AMD, Lisa Su.
Yeah, I just took a look at the price chart because I actually own AMD for my Taser portfolio too. And it looks like we are going to get a record high close today above $98. That's fantastic. So yeah, I mean, you know, I didn't know much about her, but she is, you know, just a dynamo too, just like Jensen Huang. And yeah, she really reinvented AMD in so many ways. Now they do a lot of the same things as NVIDIA because they make GPU chips for gaming too. And once they figured out, hey, these can be used for advanced computation, she jumped right into that. So I'm looking at a recent corporate slide deck of theirs. And, you know, they're really focused on the data center, too. They see the data center as a $35 billion total addressable market. And basically, you know, it's there for AMD and NVIDIA to split. So, but I think AMD can grow share there. And actually, Google just adopted AMD data center chips. So that was a big win for them. So, and you know, there's all kinds of other applications besides, you know, machine learning or the cloud or high performance computing. Virtualization. It's almost like the the gaming, you know, used to visualize data or structure data, or I mentioned something like medical education. Just a lot of exciting possibilities there. I want to find one more slide that I thought was interesting from their recent presentation. But and then they're just eating Intel's lunch in the PC, right? Because they're just coming up with the next generations of chips. You know, the big challenge right now is just getting smaller and smaller. I mentioned NVIDIA fitting, you know, tens of billions of transistors on a card that's smaller than a shoebox. Well, that's about going sub 10 nanometer. You know, a nanometer is a billionth of a meter. And, you know, even the coronavirus, which is not really a big virus, is, let's say it's 50 nanometers. And these machines are building things now at 7 nanometer scale, at 5 nanometer scale. NVIDIA has orders in with either Taiwan Semiconductor or Samsung, the big foundries, to build their next generation architectures at 5 nanometers. And I'm sure somebody is working on 3 nanometer right now. So, you know, they right. If they make them smaller and they can keep these machines cool, you know, with advanced materials, the innovations are just incredible. I mean, we talk about the computing at the edge, and the edge is, you know, distant from the cloud, maybe not even connected to the cloud, not connected to the internet. What kind of computation can you do at the edge with a device that might be as small as your phone or a watch? And this is the kind of innovation that is making computing at the edge possible for you know, all kinds of devices. Imagine your car still being intelligent and connected when you're out in the middle of nowhere.
So we talked about Google, NVIDIA, and AMD. Which are your other favorite stocks that are companies that are doing very innovative work in these advanced technologies, the stocks that investors should not ignore?
Glad you asked. I have one in particular, Cadence Design Systems, and the symbol is CDNS. And what's interesting about Cadence is they're sort of like the modern CAD-CAM. You know, CAD-CAM we used to talk about in the 80s, computer-assisted design, computer-assisted manufacture. Well, I mean, that we're 100 times ahead of what that used to be, but Cadence is what's called an EDA company, Electronic Design Automation, sometimes also called SDE, System Design Enablement. And what they do is they have the software that helps a chip manufacturer design its chips exactly the way they want. So it's like they can sit there with a stylus, you know, on a special computer interface and say, and basically draw out where they want the routes and channels of their circuit boards to go. I mentioned that this keynote that Jensen gave on June 25th in France, what was interesting when he was talking about simulation is the only product placement of partners that was featured in that discussion was Cadence. So NVIDIA is using Cadence software design systems to basically engineer their chips. So that I'm excited about that company. Who else? Oh, there's a little AI company that I'm just learning about, and it's more of a enterprise software consultant, and that's C3 AI. Had a big debut IPO last year where the stock soared. Maybe went to 180 or something. And now the stock trades at just over $50. This was started by Thomas Siebel of Siebel Systems. And so he knows his stuff. Since they're not building hardware, they're just designing software to be able to utilize AI. You know, they're not in the same category as an NVIDIA or a Cadence. But since they have a good pedigree, I'm keeping an eye on the stock. I own it. The symbol is AI. so he picked a good stock symbol there. Yeah, I think he was lucky.
Easy
to
remember.
Yeah. And sort of puts him in the industry. And I should mention that Google is also experimenting with using AI to design chips. So, you know, you think about where the future is going. Even before the singularity, we're going to have software designing software and designing chips and just making them faster, better, and cheaper than a human engineer or in collaboration with a human engineer.
Very interesting. So in the end, I wanted to talk a little bit about your thoughts on human AI collaborations, since you mentioned. And okay. Normally, some people, when they think about AI and the automation capabilities, they think that AI can put humans out of work. And in fact, I saw a recent speech by, I read about a recent speech by Google CEO Sundar Pichai, and he said that over time, AI will make humans more productive. He said that it will make humans more productive than we have ever imagined. But he said, of course, we'll have to deal with all the changes that come with it. So talk to us a little bit about how AI can increase human productivity.
Yeah, it's something I've been researching for a while, since I read Ray Kurzweil and Max Tegmark. Max Tegmark has a great YouTube video. Oh, I just remember the name of his book. It's called Life 3.0. And it's basically, you know, his vision of the singularity when we've reached artificial general intelligence. So, you know, there's many scenarios. There's we can talk about the dark scenario where, you know, the machines put people out of work and the machines take over. we can also talk about the super optimistic scenario, as you mentioned from Sundar Pichai, that AI and automation technologies could relieve us of a lot of dirty work and allow us to be more creative and productive in collaboration with those tools. And, you know, I think the reality lies somewhere in between, and I'm leaning towards the positive side, because there will be dislocations. There will be industries that get not just disrupted, but maybe wiped out by new automation. And maybe we've seen that slowly with Amazon. The other cool thing is with the pandemic, we just got a great experiment in what if, you know, what if restaurant workers and hotel workers are put out of work? So in that sense, we just did our UBI experiment, universal basic income, because the government's handing out, you know, checks for people so they can survive when they're unemployed. You know, if machines do replace a lot of work, how will people adapt? You know, and will they seek out more education? Will it inspire them to say, you know what, I can't do that job anymore because a machine took it away. Maybe it's time for me to up level my skills and my education and try something new. So I think it could create sort of a renaissance over time. You know, as Amazon has disrupted businesses, that happened in slow motion. But I think a lot of companies, you know, we just with the pandemic, the software industry basically experienced like 10 years of advancement in just 10 months, because companies just scrambled to right. automate processes and get people connected so they could work from home. So there will be some dislocations and some painful disruptions in some industries, but overall, it's fantastic for humanity, I believe. One more thing,
sure.
As I've been looking at the at AI as it connects to autonomous vehicles and autonomous driving, because NVIDIA is working on that. So is Google with Waymo. I just bought Ford, and they just partnered with a company called Argo AI, who's going to help Lyft create autonomous mm-hmm. vehicles. What was interesting is I noticed all these companies are locating in Pittsburgh. And I thought, well, gee, what's the attraction in Pittsburgh? That would be Carnegie Mellon University,
right.
where mm-hmm. your daughter went, I believe, right?
Yes, it's great for computer science.
Yeah, so it's so interesting that Pittsburgh becomes sort of this Silicon Valley tech hub, you know, mm-hmm. in middle America or the East Coast. And yeah, just exciting things happening there. And you know, the one thing I want to say about autonomous vehicles is like, yeah, most Americans don't want to give up their freedom to drive. You know, it's like, I want to drive my own car. But when I first became an investor in Mobileye, which Intel bought a few years ago, this will come in steps and stages. And here's a great example of how automation and AI will come in steps and stages that won't disrupt people's lives. Think about what the most dangerous car accident is. And the most common one, it's when you get rear-ended. And yes. because it's the most common thing, people aren't paying attention. It happens every day, hundreds of times. Somebody rear ends somebody else and causes, you know, at least some neck pain, if not a serious spinal injury. We can prevent that right now with a technology called automatic emergency braking. And that's what Mobileye was working on, is just have your car be able to tell you when it's about to hit something. And most new cars have sensors for that, but also actually be able to apply the brake and prevent what could be a very deadly accident. And if we just work that in, and government mandates that all cars should have automatic emergency braking, we're already taking the first baby step towards, you know, autonomous vehicles. And you could still drive your own car, but let's take the safety up a level or two. So that's sort of my sermon on bringing AI and automation into people's daily lives and making it friendly.
Perfect. Thanks so much for joining us today, Kevin. Really enjoyed the discussion.
Oh, yeah. Thanks for having me, Nina.
So that was Kevin Cook. Now, there are many ETFs to invest in advanced technologies. And I believe the best way to get exposure to all companies doing a lot of interesting work in this area in a single fund is through the NASDAQ 100 ETF QQQ, or its cheaper version QQQM. So QQQ has an expense ratio of 20 basis points and QQQM has an expense ratio of just 15 basis points. So QQQ is better for traders because of its liquidity, and QQQM is better for long-term investors. Now, when we think about examples, applications of AI in our daily lives, we think of smartphones, smart cars, drones, video games, smart home devices, e-commerce, and the companies which are doing a lot of work in these areas are Apple, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, NVIDIA, and you will find exposure to all these companies in a single ETF through this fund. Now, if you want more targeted exposure to AI and automation, then you can look at IRBO. It is the iShares Robotics and Artificial Intelligence ETF. It is the cheapest robotics and AI ETF, and is definitely worth a look. And I own it in the ETF investor portfolio. If you are a Cathie Wood fan and like her active management, then probably you should look at ARKQ, which is the ARK Autonomous Technology and Robotics ETF. Now, if you want even more targeted exposure just to the AI theme or the AI ecosystem, then there are some ETFs focused only on AI. This one by Robo Global, it is the Robo Global Artificial Intelligence ETF, ticker symbol THNQ. It invests in companies around the world which are leading the AI revolution. This one by Global X, the ticker symbol is AIQ, Global X Artificial Intelligence and Technology ETF. This also invests in companies that stand to benefit from further development and utilization of AI technology. Now, I should mention that all these funds, except for QQQ, IR funds like IRBO, ARKQ, AIQ, and THNQ, they all have China exposure because there's a lot of work, a lot of innovative work being done by Chinese companies in this area. And these four funds are global funds. They have global exposure. And we know that Chinese companies have taken a beating lately because of the government's regulatory crackdown. And that is the reason why QQQ has outperformed all these four ETFs this year, particularly in the past few weeks when Chinese stocks tumbled. So if you want to avoid any Chinese exposure till there is more visibility on the situation in China, then again, QQQ and QQQM are your best options. Thanks for listening. If you like our podcast, please leave us a rating on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcast. And also make sure to subscribe so that you do not miss any episode. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, please email podcast@sax.com.
This material is being provided for informational purposes only, and nothing herein constitutes investment, legal, accounting, or tax advice, or a recommendation to buy, sell, or hold a security. Do not act or rely upon the information and advice given in this podcast without seeking the services of competent and professional legal, tax, or accounting counsel. Publication and distribution of this podcast is not intended to create, and the information contained herein does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. No recommendation or advice is being given as to whether any investment or strategy is suitable for a particular investor. It should not be assumed that any investments in securities, companies, sectors, or markets identified and described were or will be profitable. All information is current as of the date herein and is subject to change without notice. Any views or opinions expressed may not reflect those of Zacks Investment Research as a whole.